Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
All right, welcome to Behind the Knife. I'm Jason.
I'm Kevin.
And I'm Scott.
And we have a great show for you today. Scott, what's on the OR schedule?
Well, we're really privileged today to have Dr. Matthew Jeffrey Martin, who is the Surgical Director of Research and the Chief of Trauma at Madigan Army Medical Center. He's going to talk to us about initial evaluation and resuscitation of patients, both in the civilian sector and in trauma. In our random fact of the day, we're going to talk about midfoot injuries and the famous eponym that has gone on with that. And finally, in our tips and tricks, Dr. Matthew Martin is going to tell us a little bit more about penetrating chest injuries.
All right, all that and more coming up, but first, our opening shot.
Okay, so in today's opening shot, we're going to parlay a little bit what we're going to talk about Dr. Martin in terms of combat trauma and initial resuscitation and some of the more practical points in terms of getting patients in that pre-hospital setting. So it's important to understand when you talk about organizational structures, there's really three different components of it. Number one, the pre-hospital component, and this involves who's taking care of the patients, how are they getting there, what abilities do they have in that particular one, which is obviously different in a rural setting versus a more city setting. And then in the emergency department, and then finally getting the patient to the operating room. Jake, trauma is really different than medicine. How do we think about these? It's obvious, but it's well worth saying.
Yeah, you know, and these are, you know, generalizations, but in general, you know, medicine is slow and oftentimes not urgent. Where trauma, you're rapid, we're talking seconds to minutes for life. You know, medicine, you have time to go thorough, consider all the data, make the diagnosis and treat. But in trauma, you got to prioritize you got to allocate your resources, prioritize the patients. Often you're working with incomplete data and you have to initiate therapy before you really have all the information.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the major components is we're talking about oftentimes you're initiating therapy prior to making and understanding what the diagnosis, you're making the diagnosis as it comes in. So question to you, you got a 20-year-old guy in a pre-hospital setting, and he's a soldier, you're in a combat environment, and he's got a gunshot wound to the abdomen, he's unconscious, heart rate's 120s. What pre-hospital intervention should be done? You know, we talk about our ABCs, ATLS, and, you know, we go through the thing. Where are you at? What are you going to do? Do we have the ability to have do we have good truncal hemorrhage control? Mm-hmm. And that's something that we're going to talk a little bit with Dr. Martin about. And should that patient undergo an intubation? So intubation has been looked at in a couple of different settings. Can you talk a little bit about life-saving intubation, if you will?
Sure. A couple of different people have looked at this. There's some data coming out of the Los Angeles County with Murray in the journal Trauma 2000 that showed worse outcomes actually in patients with pre-hospital intubation, particularly for children with head injuries. Other studies in journal Trauma 2002, the German trauma system showed prolonged scene time, increased fluid requirements, and no survival benefit to intubation in the field.
Yeah, it's really interesting when you think about this. Obviously, we're not saying that if a person needs an emergent airway, that you shouldn't try to get that emergent airway access. Mm-hmm. But when you really look at some of the data out there, it questions what are we doing at the scene of the at the injury of the accident, and could we do anything else? And this parlays very much into that entire scoop and run. Yep. Versus what you should do. And can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so looking at, from studies back in the 90s from Dimitriadis and colleagues, where they looked at, about 5,000, greater than 5,000 patients who were matched for age, injury severity score, and looking at EMS transport versus, private transport, what they actually found was surprising, that the mortality was higher with EMS transport, and particularly for, severely injured patients, the mortality doubled with EMS transport.
Yeah, and I know I think that speaks a little bit more to getting the patients where they can have definitive care. This is obviously easy. That study came out of LA County where, you drop off the patient, get them right to the ER versus somewhere where it's a little bit more rural. They might not have that, but it does go towards this entire thought process of evaluating what is felt to be surgical dogma. Are we doing the right things there in terms of a helicopter? And I do take some trauma call, and we have some people that come in on life flight. Obviously, in a military, there's no real good military series out about this, but in terms of civilian type series, what's going on with that?
This is looking at the helicopter transport, you know, it's controversial, but some civilian studies have shown no survival benefit with this, you know, and this probably related to longer time at scene and longer transport times. And generally, there's a question of whether or not this is cost effective.
We talk about initial evaluation in the emergency department and really what should happen in there. And again, that goes to the basic principles of having good prioritization with our ABCDEs and resuscitate that patient. But along those lines, in addition, we talk about initial resuscitation. The old school dogma, you know, to every patient needs two large bore IVs. We need to get an ET tube in the appropriate patient, fluid resuscitate them, tubes and lines in every orifice. I remember hearing that when I was an intern. Mm-hmm. We're imaging them from head to toe. You know, there is something, if we break down the ABCDs a little bit more and kind of dissect them and try to match what is imperative in each patient, starting with airway. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, and this is, you know, getting away from, again, from the dogma that you need a tube in every orifice. Airway does not necessarily mean intubation. You know, if you have an intact airway, it's hard to really improve on that. Mm-hmm. Bag valve mask does work. And you stop and ask yourself, why not intubate? Then, you know, you have a secure airway, but there's time associated with that. It's difficulty. There's complications associated with that. You have CO2 problems, CO2 retention.
And that's not to say that, you know, once that airway gets in, you can potentially have a loss of airway. You lose your ability to examine this patient and interact with them. And we know that the medications that often they give them, these can result in hypotension or even cardiac collapse. So, you know, there are certain things with the, you know, generalized with bleeding and everything. They're the emergent things that we need to be able to do. We need to be able to, you know, recognize those patients who have a tension pneumothorax that would need something emergent. And this is something we're going to talk about a little bit with Dr. Martin in terms of a needle. Mm-hmm. A lot of people come with a needle, and how effective is that? And what is the data out there really about the utility of needling someone's chest? And we're going to talk that with Dr. Martin a little bit more about. One of the biggest things that is a problem in early causes of death, not just head injury, everything, but, you know, patients that have uncontrollable hemorrhage, and what are we going to do with those particular patients, and what specifically are the problem areas where the focus as we go forward in terms of that, and tell us a little bit about that.
I think this is one of the more exciting areas where there's been a lot of data coming out of the military experience that can really save lives in that early that golden hour in trauma resuscitation. Is controlling hemorrhage. Certainly with extremity trauma, there's been the reintroduction and the common use of the tourniquet has probably been the biggest thing. As you move up and you get to those harder to control junctional hemorrhages, some of the different hemostatic agents and dressings and devices have made great grounds. And even now, you know, we're looking at things like the REBOA and controlling truncal hemorrhage.
And along with that, you know, just what is resuscitation with the patients? What are the agents out there? Not only the circulation versus blood, which we've talked to in previous podcasts, but also the ability of these adjunct agents. When should we be instituting massive transfusion protocols? What is the role of TXA and everything? And really, are all fluids created equal? I mean, is there something between crystalloids? Is there something between what is our ideal resuscitation fluid?
So, you know, we're really getting away from the use of crystalloids. You know, crystalloids are often inefficient. They're heavy to carry around for your pre-hospital providers. They can be pro-inflammatory. They prime the immune system, increase neutrophil sequestration, and increase cytokine release, which it can actually cause damage.
Yeah, and so an ideal resuscitation, again, it'd be efficient for both a combat setting as well as some other situations. Lighter would be better. They'd be immune neutral or beneficial, and they're going to be safe. And, you know, whether it's hypertonic saline or some colloid solutions, I'm not really sure if we're exactly there yet. Jay, let's moving on to disability, the essence of disability evaluation.
Yeah, really in your primary survey, when you're talking about disability, the two things that should be at the top of your mind and the only thing you're really concerned about is the patient's GCS and their pupils.
Yeah, we talk all the time. That's not the time to get your full neurological evaluation and get everything out. So again, we're going to get into all these more in depth with Dr. Martin. We just wanted to give you a little bit of primer in terms of the initial evaluation and pre-hospital care and you know, debunking some of those dogmas that are out there.
Well, you know what that sound means? It's time for our random fact of the day.
Okay, for those of you who out there who follow a lot of trauma or follow a lot of sports, you've heard of the dreaded Liz Franck injury. The Liz Franck or the Liz Franck injury is a fracture actually of the tarsal metatarsal joint. It's an area or an injury of the midfoot where one or more of the metatarsal bones are displaced from the tarsus. Kevin, how did this become known as the Liz Franck injury?
This is named after Jacques Lisfranc de Saint-Martin, born in 1790 and died in 1847. He's a French surgeon and gynecologist who described this injury during the War of the Six Coalitions.
You didn't take French in...
I did not. No, more that, Spanish.
That's obvious.
During the Napoleonic Wars, Jacques encountered a soldier who suffered from vascular compromise and secondary gangrene after a fall from a horse.
How did that happen?
He got his foot caught in the stirrup and the horse came out from under him. Subsequently, Lisfranc performed an amputation at the level of the tarsometatarsal joints, and that area has since been known as the Lisfranc joint.
Is that all he did, though?
No, actually. Jacques Lisfranc de Saint-Martin is actually surprisingly not an orthopedist. He is a pioneering French surgeon and a gynecologist. He invented a number of operations, including removal of the rectum, the lithotomy in women, and amputation of the cervix.
And that has been your random fact of the day. So welcome to Behind the Knife. We are absolutely thrilled to have Dr. Matthew Jeffrey Martin, who is the Trauma Medical Director and Director of Surgical Research at Madigan Army Medical Center. He is also the Chair of the Army Committee on Trauma. Matt, welcome to Behind the Knife.
Thank you. It's great to be here at the BTK corporate headquarters.
Awesome. So, Matt, for those who don't have as much of a understanding about your background, can you walk us a little bit through where you're from, where you trained, and how it came to the point where you're at your stage in your career?
Sure. So, I'm from and grew up in New Jersey.
Nice.
Jersey represent. I went to undergrad, grad school, and med school at Boston University, so spent quite a bit of time on the East Coast. Of course, I was on Army scholarship at medical school, so then I came out west to Madigan Army Medical Center, where I did my residency. I did my fellowship in trauma and critical care at USC, Los Angeles County Hospital. And then since then, I've been back at Madigan as staff, except for several nice trips to the Mideast.
How did you get, what made you decide to go the Army medicine route?
I was actually Army ROTC in college, and I had one big driving factor for that, money.
Yeah.
Boston University was pretty expensive. I needed some way to help pay for that, and the Army seemed like a reasonable option. Also, I have several family members, including my father, who were in the Army, so you know that played a part. So I was ROTC. Did my time in college, served after college, and then when I got accepted to medical school, it seemed like a natural fit, and I wanted to continue on with a military career.
It continues to be lucrative, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, now it's time for the segment of the podcast we call the Dissection of the Day, and this is the segment where we delve more in depth about a particular surgical topic. And since we have you with us today, Dr. Martin, we thought we would talk about lessons learned from the combat experience and how we can apply that to civilian trauma. So let's start with the pre-hospital resuscitation. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of the hemostatic agents and devices that have come out of our combat experience and how we can transition those into civilian practice.
Sure. So, and I think pre-hospital is probably where we've made some of the most important advances, at least on the battlefield, and that's starting to be translated to the civilian sector. And we've really proven the benefit of some incredibly high-tech products like a tourniquet, a stick, and a piece of Velcro.
Right.
That's probably been one of the biggest advances in the combat experience. And it wasn't just, let's get a tourniquet that works. It was, let's field tourniquets. Let's have every soldier with at least one, better off two, tourniquets in their uniform. And probably the experience from the Ranger Regiment that Russ Cotwall has published, of they trained every soldier, you know, to be a combat medic, to apply a tourniquet, to apply hemostatic dressing, and they showed a marked decrease in their killed in action, no preventable deaths, which if you look at the big series, our preventable death rate is about 25% mm-hmm. of battlefield deaths. So tourniquets, the simplest thing in the world, has been, you know, responsible for probably more lives saved than anything else. And then the other big advance has been hemostatic dressings. For hundreds of years, we've gone to war with nothing more advanced than a gauze dressing. Mm-hmm. This is the first wars we've gone with something more advanced than that. And we've gone through a bunch of generations of products, and we have some very good products now that can be applied to wounds that aren't necessarily something you can put a tourniquet on.
Are there some that you feel are better than others?
To do the party line, the Army party line, which is the Tactical Committee for Combat Casualty Care, the approved dressing has been combat gauze for the past about 5 years. They just approved two of the chitosan gauze products as effective as combat gauze. And those are the ones I have the experience with. Those are called passive dressings. They're very good at stopping bleeding. They don't bring any external clotting factors to the game. I think the next big advance that we're looking at now are so-called active dressings, and those actually contain precursors or active coagulation factors. And so theoretically, they should work in the cold coagulopathic patient where some of the current hemostatic dressings might fail. And there's a whole bunch of other G-Wiz technologies and devices that are coming on the market.
Are any of those active dressings on the market currently with the clotting factors?
Several of them are. They're really only approved for mostly intraoperative use. And really the main ones are ones that have fibrinogen or fibrin precursors. Yeah. And there's a couple of them that are approved mainly for use in the OR. One of the problems in terms of trauma use for those is they're generally very small. Yeah. You know, they're a couple centimeters square that you can put on a little, you know, bleeding liver or spleen capsule or tear. So the next generation will be advancing those to a bigger product that can be applied to a large trauma wound that's bleeding, or even intra-op to a big solid organ injury right. that's bleeding.
Continuing on the controlling hemorrhage topic, we know that with these IED blasts and things we've seen a lot of junctional hemorrhage, and they can be pretty devastating. What have we come up with that? Have we made any advances in that field?
Well, the hemostatic dressings that I just mentioned, those were really developed for junctional hemorrhage. Hmm. You know, you have three categories, extremity, junctional, and then truncal. Extremity tourniquets are the main solution. If they're still bleeding, add a second tourniquet. You can add a hemostatic dressing, but those were really developed for the junctional hemorrhage. And the drive behind that, a lot of that was the Somalia experience, you know, that many people have seen in Black Hawk Down. Mm-hmm. The one scene where the soldier has a high femoral vessel that retracts and bleeds to death. Some of the doctors like John Holcomb, who came out of that, and Peter Ree, who had other experiences with those types of wounds, said we need a product that can control that type of wound, and that's where they came out with the hemostatic dressing. So that's why I think combat gauze and the other gauze roll products are probably the best, because you know they're new advanced dressings, but they're basically a gauze roll for the medic. They know how to pack gauze into a wound, mm-hmm. so they don't need a lot of extra training. The other big excitement now is they've developed junctional tourniquets mm-hmm. that can be applied to these junctional injuries, mostly femoral. One of them can be applied to axillary or subclavian. There's three or four products on the market. There's one called the Croc, one called the Jet. There's a SAM, the same company that makes the pelvic binders. The Jet and the SAM appear to be pretty effective, and those are being fielded now. And we have at least 15 or 20 documented uses of them in theater.
You know, we talked to Dr. Maddox, we talked to Ben Starnes, and we talked to Holcomb on the Behind the Knife podcast previously. And it's funny, the little bit slightly different thoughts and angles about the Reboa system. You know, how practical, how it should be implemented. Is it going to hit, in again, not only in the combat setting, but also in civilian trauma? I'm curious as to your thoughts about that, and where is it now, and where do you see it fitting, if at all, as we go forward into use in the civilian sector?
Yeah, and that's, I think that's the usual sequence of names that people think of in trauma. They usually think Maddox, Holcomb, Martin. So it's it's humbling to be mentioned in the same breath as those kind of names. So from my lower level opinion, I think Roboa is another interesting technology, and that's really because our final hurdle is truncal hemorrhage. We do not have an answer for truncal hemorrhage other than get him to a surgeon as quick as possible and do damage control resuscitation and hypotensive resuscitation. Other than that, we don't have an answer for those patients. Roboa is one potential answer. There's very good animal data supporting it. It works. You know, it essentially cross-clamps the aorta and with a lot less physiologic insult than doing an open cross-clamp. I think the big hurdle in that is there's a lot of push, and it's being sold as this is a pre-hospital intervention.
Right.
And we are nowhere close to being able to deploy that as a pre-hospital intervention because, one, you need to look at efficacy, especially for pre-hospital interventions. But the other thing you have to look at is the price you pay if you're wrong and the complications that can happen. And there's such potential complications of applying this technology wrong. And if you just think about it, a lot of active surgeons or trauma surgeons, you tell them, go put a balloon in the aorta, and they wouldn't be comfortable with it. And now we're going to tell a medic to do that in a battlefield environment. So I think Roboa is great. I see it as an ER intervention for now. I don't see it moving to the pre-hospital environment anytime soon, other than very select situations, like a situation where a surgeon or a ER physician is in a frontline area, or for very, very select, highly trained medics. And in our community, that would generally be the special forces medics. Outside of that, I really don't see it as a pre-hospital intervention at this point.
Along with truncal injuries, you know, one of the more troublesome things to control in the field would be pelvic bleeding from pelvic fractures. What devices are out there, and what techniques do you have for controlling pelvic bleeding pre-hospital?
Yeah, and one big discerner there would be if you're talking about the military type pelvic trauma or the civilian type. So starting with the civilian type, everybody knows, you know, you sheet them, you put a pelvic binder on, that'll help collapse the volume of the pelvis. Those are both relatively effective. And again, for pre-hospital now, we really don't have a good answer for that. Roboa is a good solution for that. Again, I don't see it as a pre-hospital intervention. For the combat-type pelvic injuries, those are some of the worst you'll see because if they got a bad pelvic fracture from an IED, that generally means they're also coming with 1, 2, sometimes 3 amputations, high vascular injuries, and open pelvic fracture. And in fact, we now have a name for that. It's called a complex dismounted blast injury. Those have incredibly high mortality, hard to get vascular control. We don't have great answers other than apply a pelvic binder, apply hemostatic dressings and tourniquets because there's usually high amputations. Mm-hmm. The SAM junctional tourniquet is actually basically a pelvic binder that has 2 inflatable pads that go over the groin so you can inflate them to control groin hemorrhage. So that can do both for you. The other lesson is those patients need to be in the OR as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. Those patients do not need CT scans. And in the OR, you need to make a quick decision of how I get vascular control. And it's either do I have the room to go directly to the high amputations and get proximal groin control, or often in the experience it's been just start with a laparotomy, get intra-abdominal control of the distal iliacs, and then go from there.
Great, sir. Can you talk a little bit about the role of TXA? Who should administer this, when, and what are the risks involved with this?
Yeah, and TXA is another hotly debated area. You know, we all know there was the big CRASH II trial. Mm-hmm. It showed a survival benefit, and so TXA is being pretty widely used now. A couple things you have to understand about the CRASH II data. One, it's civilian trauma and mostly blunt trauma. But the other thing is that survival benefit is incredibly small. You know, it was 2 percentage points
right.
of a benefit. And they had to do a study with, you know, 20,000 patients randomized to show that was statistically significant. The real question is getting into subgroups. Who's the best subgroup to use it on? And obviously, it appears that bleeding patients have the best bang for their buck, and massive transfusion patients probably have a little better bang for their buck with TXA. The nice thing is it's safe and it's cheap. I mean, we have decades of data with TXA, pediatric heart surgery, adult heart surgery, orthopedic surgery. It's used routinely in big joint cases, and it's safe. There's no evidence of increased thrombotic events. The only safety concern raised in the CRASH II trial is if you give it late, after 3 hours. That, though, was kind of an outlier finding, and personally, I don't believe that it's harmful at that point. I think that was an abnormality in the data. So who to give it to? The problem that we've applied it is it's become part of a massive transfusion protocol. So only patients that get a massive transfusion. If you look at the CRASH data, patients that got any transfusion had the same benefit as massive transfusion. And in fact, if you limit it only to massive transfusion, you're eliminating 85% of the patients that by the CRASH II trial should get a benefit from TXA. So mm-hmm. It should be really thought of as an intervention for bleeding trauma patients, not for just massive transfusion patients. We're going to see a whole bunch of data coming out in the next couple of years. There's at least 2 pre-hospital TXA studies going on. The other place I think it's going to be a huge benefit is TBI. You know, you have a patient with an intracranial hemorrhage where getting 100 cc's less blood loss can be a huge difference. There's the CRASH III trial is ongoing. That's a trial of TXA in traumatic brain injury. There's also now a trial that just started. In fact, in this area, I think Portland is the lead on it, again, of pre-hospital TXA in TBI patients. So we're really looking forward to seeing that data. But I would give it for a trauma patient that's bleeding. And in my mind, they're bleeding and they're going to lose. It's not a little minor bleed. They're going to start getting blood transfusion. That's the patient you should think about giving in. The other patient, there's a lot of push now to use thromboelastography mm-hmm. or thromboelastometry, TEG or Rotem. And if you see evidence of increased fibrinolysis, that's probably a good patient to give it to. But also, we don't want to limit it to those patients because, again, if you limit it to just patients with hyperfibrinolysis, you're eliminating most of the patients that by the CRASH II should have a benefit from TXA.
Matt, what happened to Factor VII? And it was all the rage not too long ago. And where is it now?
Yeah, Factor VII. Factor VII is the TXA in the bizarro world. Mm-hmm. If TXA is safe and cheap, and Factor VII is incredibly expensive and dangerous. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about a drug that anywhere from $10,000 to $25,000 to give a patient a course of treatment. It has been associated with some prothrombotic events. And some of that was exaggerated. It got a very bad name in the press.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, the company got hit with I believe it was $25 million, fine for inappropriate marketing of it. Mm-hmm. But then the 2 big randomized trials came out and showed that really there wasn't any benefit of TXA other than a slight decrease in transfusion. I mean, Factor VII. But there was no mortality benefit, no other measurable benefit. So just something that breaks the bank like that and you can't show a benefit and potential downsides, it really went away. It still has some specific uses, patients with factor deficiencies, patients who need Coumadin reverse quickly. You can use it with PCC. But other than that, it's really gone away from the trauma community.
So switching away now from bleeding to other things that can kill you quickly in the pre-hospital setting is attention pneumothorax. And, the standard teaching has always been needle decompression for attention pneumothorax. What are the problems with that and what are some potential solutions?
Well, one of the biggest problems is just identifying it and who should and shouldn't get a needle. If you look at who gets a needle, a lot of times it's done for decreased breath sounds, which isn't an indication for a needle. An indication should be signs of attention pneumothorax. Mm-hmm. The problem with the intervention itself is we have a obviously life-threatening pathology. Every medical student is taught signs of attention pneumothorax and it can kill you. And we use a device that wasn't designed at all for treating attention pneumothorax. Right. It was designed for running IV fluids into somebody's arm. 50% of them never make it in the chest and so have no chance of being effective. And that's been pretty well recognized. The solution to that, unfortunately, was, we just need to use longer angiocaths because the thought was the problem is they're just not going deep enough. Well, even when you do that, there's still a very high failure rate. And that's because it's not only did it make it into the chest, it's just do these flimsy little angiocatheters give you adequate drainage of attention pneumothorax. In some cases, they will. In a significant number, they'll fail. We've done a couple studies in our lab of just placing them, and this is an animal under anesthesia, not moving, controlled scenario, and we place it for attention pneumothorax, and at least a third of them fail. And this is a perfectly placed needle in the chest. They become dislodged with just simple things like breathing, the movement of the chest wall. And then if you think about transporting a patient, they kink. They get, you know, one drop of blood or tissue in the tip, and they're clogged off. So we've looked at a couple alternatives to those devices. We've looked at using small 5-millimeter trocars. Those were as effective as chest tubes, and they were designed for placement into a body cavity without damaging underlying structures. Peter Rees' group in Tucson has looked at a modified Varis needle. There's a couple other groups looking at other products. So the big thing there is we need a device that actually works and works reliably for tension pneumothorax.
Take us a little bit into switching final gears into trauma resuscitation. You got a patient. What's your approach to an unstable patient? They got massive hemorrhage. They're in the trauma bay. What are your thought process? How do you walk through that particular patient? What's the role? Is there a role at DPL anymore? We used to be able to do it, you know, versus DPA, the fast examination. Many patients or places that I've worked at have the CAT scanner right next door. Should we be zipping right to CAT scan? Are we at that level yet? That patient that first comes in.
Yeah, so, well, to answer the first question, DPL, there's almost no role for DPL in the initial trauma resuscitation. And how many DPLs have you done, Scott?
A few. I mean, back in the day when we were at Harborview, you know, we used to do a fair amount of DPLs, but that was like the last bastion of being able to do them.
How many DPLs have you two done, our residents?
I did one last week, actually, at Harborview, though. Yeah.
I've done and seen zero.
So you did one at Harborview. What was the indication?
Equivocal fast in a
unstable
patient.
Okay. So I think the only place I think DPL still has utility is that scenario. Unstable patient, equivocal fast or negative fast. And obviously, you know, the weakness of fast is a negative, false negative. So you still suspect the abdomen. But I think DPA, diagnostic peritoneal aspirate, has replaced DPL. Mm-hmm. So you put a needle in, or you can put the DPL catheter in, you aspirate. If you get gross blood, then there's your answer.
Yep.
The bleeding is in that cavity. But what you don't do is then follow it with the 1 liter of fluid and then wait for it to run back and send it to the lab. You know, those results are meaningless. You'll never get them back in time to make any decisions.
Right.
So the approach to that patient, you have the unstable, I'm assuming unstable patient, and you don't know where the bleeding is.
Correct.
Because it's, you know where the bleeding is, that's the easy one. And that's the tough patient. One answer to that is don't take them to CAT scan. You can do a rapid assessment to identify hemorrhage in 5 minutes at the bedside. Mm-hmm. And the first principle is enough bleeding to make you unstable is not subtle. And there's only a couple places it can hide if it's not on the floor or at the scene. So assuming it's not external, which should be obvious, you know, really you're left with, is it chest, abdomen, pelvis, or then people talk about the bilateral femur injuries, which I have yet to see, you know, somebody exsanguinate from those type of injuries. So chest, a chest x-ray. As soon as they arrive, you shoot a chest x-ray. Or now you can do an ultrasound, an extended fast, and that'll tell you pneumo hemothorax reliably. The abdomen. That's your exam and your fast exam. And if you're still equivocal, you can do a DPA. The pelvis is mostly your physical exam. You know, if you do a normal physical exam, they don't have an unstable pelvic fracture, it's unlikely they're bleeding death from their pelvis. But you also get a pelvis x-ray and your fast. And so all that can be done and should be done in 3 to 5 minutes. And that usually will give you your answer. And if all that's negative, then you start going down the other weird routes of, you know, cardiac contusion, is it a spinal cord injury, some other cause of hypotension. The other caveat to that I think has been an advance that we need to apply more is direct to the OR resuscitation. Mm-hmm. For that type of patient. They don't need to be in the ED. They don't need to be getting centralized and intubated. I do some work down at Legacy Emanuel in Portland. They have a direct-to-OR policy, and that patient you described would go direct to OR because they're unstable. And you can do everything you need to do right in the OR, and then if they need an operation, you're ready to start your operation. You're not delaying 30 minutes doing all the usual stuff in the ED. And they've shown some very good results with that approach. I think that's something that should be adopted more in trauma centers.
We recently had Dr. Holcomb on the show talking about the proper trial and the one-to-one-to-one. Is this being widespread? Are you seeing this in Portland? Is there a role for crystalloid anymore? Who are you starting your massive resuscitations on?
Yeah, there is a role for crystalloid, and the role is used as little as possible. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in most of the patients, it really makes no difference. You know, 90% of the patients aren't having large volume bleeding. And if they get a liter of crystalloid one way or the other, it's not going to make a difference. But in the patient who's bleeding, that's where you can really hurt or help them by how you resuscitate, how you give blood products, and how you give crystalloid and how much. And our old approach used to be we flood them with crystalloid, then we give them a lot of cold pack cells, and then we get an INR back a couple hours later, and then we thaw FFP, it takes another hour, and then we start trying to correct their coagulopathy. And John Holcomb has obviously been a leader in changing how we do business with that to an early goal-directed resuscitation, including balanced products, so FFP, platelets, and pack cells. The proper trial is kind of interesting because you know, it really showed no difference between a 1-to-1 and a 1-to-2 strategy, other than some secondary endpoints of 24-hour bleeding deaths that didn't translate into long-term mortality benefit. So on the one side, people are taking this data as saying there's no benefit of a damage control approach. On the other side, people are saying, well, there were decreased early bleeding deaths, so everyone should get a 1-to-1. And then in the middle point has been they're both good resuscitation strategies. The problem is they really should have compared 1-to-1 versus how we used to do business, which was, you know, a lot of crystalloid, some pack cells, FFP only for lab abnormalities. The IRB, this gets back to the IRB, wouldn't let them do that. In fact, they wanted to do a 1-to-3 or a 1-to-4, and the IRB wouldn't let them do that because they said there was enough data supporting the 1-to-1 or 1-to-2. So the problem with that trial is I think they compared two very good and reasonable resuscitation strategies, a 1-to-1 or a 1-to-2. I think the underlying message is you have a policy that shoots for those goals, because usually you'll come up a little bit short. But if you're shooting for a 1-to-1 and you get to a 1-to-2 or 1-to-1.5, you've done a very good resuscitation.
You talked a little bit about the goals and all that. So what do you use? Goal directed, protocol driven? See what the patient's doing. What is your thought process there?
Yeah, I think it's protocol driven, and that's the way to do it. And if you make it automatic, then people don't have to think about it, and it'll actually happen. So you activate your massive, and the big question is, who do you activate it on? Mm-hmm. And you know, there's pretty good studies on simple predictors of who needs a massive transfusion, and that's usually based on physiology and lab values or injury patterns. And so hypotension is always the number one. You know, evidence of a significant acidosis, presenting evidence of a coagulopathy, and then injury patterns, which would be penetrating truncal with hypotension, which would be amputations, open pelvis fractures. Those are your big indications. And there's very good data on different scoring systems like the ABC score. Mm-hmm. And so if your patient meets those criteria, you activate a protocol. The blood should come in predetermined ratios, so that makes it easy. Actually, one of the other problems that they ran into in designing the prompt trial was making sure that the patients would get the FFP and platelets. Because the tendency is, you know, you have an unstable patient and anesthesia is doing their resuscitation and they want to give all the pack cells and give the pack cells and then give the FFP and platelets later. Yeah. So their protocol actually specified they had to start off with a platelets. Certain number of platelets and FFP along with the pack cells, which is good. Because again, the tendency is to give a lot of pack cells and then get the FFP and especially platelets later. But I think a protocol driven approach, I think the counter to that that's becoming more widespread is using TEG or ROTEM as a goal and then directing resuscitation based on those goals. We don't have any level one evidence yet that is a good way to do things or shows a benefit. It makes sense. Holcomb's group in Texas and probably Gene Moore's group in Denver are the two huge proponents of that. And they should be coming out with actually a randomized trial from Denver soon that looks at that of TEG-based resuscitation versus standard. So I'm interested to see that kind of data. I think that's becoming more of a standard approach in level one trauma centers. And in fact, at John Holcomb's place and Brian Cotton in Texas, they've abandoned coags. They don't even check coags other than someone who's on Coumadin. They base everything off the TEG. And if the TEG's normal, you know, they say they don't need correction. They don't care what their INR is.
Sure. Stepping back to the pre-hospital phase, any thoughts about scoop and run versus the EMS type thing? Is it a real thing? I know it depends a little bit about what's there and where, what part of the country and everything you live in, but what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so really that scoop and run versus what we call stay and play. And the civilian data, I think, has been pretty unequivocal that scoop and run is a better approach. You know, the faster you get that patient to a trauma center, especially if they're bleeding or need interventions, the better. And the more pre-hospital interventions you do, the worse outcomes. You know, LA County did a interesting study where they compared patients that got brought, and they have a high penetrating population, mm-hmm. patients that got brought to them by the ambulance, EMS, versus what they would call the homeboy transport, which is the car pulls up, kicks the person out onto right. the side, and then peels off.
Right.
And outcomes were actually better in the patients that got driven there, thrown into a car and driven there and, you know, and kicked out in the ER than EMS transport.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that just highlighted the point of you don't want to spend a whole lot of time at the scene. On the combat side, and in some of the European data, there's been some interesting results on, they don't do a stay and play, they don't do a scoop and run, they do what would be called a scoop and play. So they'll send more assets or providers out, and in Afghanistan, the Brits use a platform called MERT, where it's a big Chinook helicopter that you can do a lot of work in. They'll send a full medical team, including a physician, an anesthesiologist, blood products. They have surgical equipment there. They'll pick the patient up, and they'll start interventions on the way to the hospital, which includes blood transfusion, central line, chest tubes, even some more major surgical procedures. They've shown that for patients that are in that middle injured group, so uninjured patients or minimally injured don't benefit. Severely injured that are going to die no matter what you do don't benefit. But that middle group, they showed a survival benefit with their system versus our you know, standard transport system using, you know, a Black Hawk and a couple medics and scoop and run. So that's going to be an interesting area in the future of, you know, should we be deploying that for select severely injured patients and doing the scoop and play hybrid.
Mm-hmm.
Sir, I just want to use your expertise to touch on one more difficult situation. The patient that comes in with an intra-abdominal bleed, also with an intracranial injury, how do you approach this patient and balance those two?
The intra-abdominal takes precedent. You know, in a lot of ways, and it depends. Do you know the patient has an intracranial bleed? So the real dilemma is the patient who comes in and let's say your FAST is positive and you know they're bleeding in their belly and you're unsure about their head. So the first principle is it's very uncommon to have patients that need both a craniotomy and laparotomy.
Mm-hmm.
A couple studies have, you know, tried to look for those patients and extremely low, way less than 1%. So fortunately for us, that's very uncommon. But the dilemma is really, do I need to get a head CT or do I need to start doing, you know, something crazy like blind burr holes?
Yeah.
So I think the answer is, you know, you treat the thing you know you can treat and you know that's going on, which is the abdominal bleeding. Hypotension's bad for the bleeding injured patient. If you can make a quick stop in CT and get a head CT for a patient with a high suspicion, that's reasonable based on your judgment. But use your exam. If the patient is awake and talking, it's not an issue. They don't need an emergent craniotomy. You know, if their pupils are equal and reactive, you know, let's say they're intubated, but they were moving everything, pupils are equal and reactive, again, highly unlikely to need anything done in their head, even if there is a bleed. So in those scenarios, just go with the abdomen. You know, there's so many M&Ms of why'd the patient die in CT? I wanted to get a quick head CT or I wanted to do a quick scan of everything. Just get them to the OR, treat the abdomen, and then sort out the head, unless you have physical exam evidence of intracranial hypertension.
Mm-hmm. Matt, one of the things I've heard you ask the residents time and time again, which always astounds me that we have so much difficulty with it, is the D of the primary survey and really what encompasses that D. I think it's well worth saying, and if you could just kind of talk about that. And then also, Are we ever going to get to the point where there is something better than what we're doing right now in terms of that neurological assessment that doesn't give us anything more than kind of where we're at?
Yeah, so the point there is that the primary survey is to identify life-threatening pathology only. It's not to do a full physical exam and identify all your injuries. Mm-hmm. So D, and I harp on this, is just geez, when I say what's D, and people start saying, well, disability. You know, you take all their clothes off, you look for any fractures.
Their reflexes, right?
Yeah, you test their reflexes. You know, you get out your tuning fork and test fine and vibratory position sense. It's just GCS and pupils. Mm-hmm. And you're looking for intracranial hypertension. You know, that's the killer in the brain that if you miss, the patient dies. So, and if somebody has a normal GCS, they do not have intracranial hypertension. That's the other thing I've seen is GCS of 15 talking, but they have unequal pupils. You know, like maybe they have anisocoria, or maybe they have a facial injury, optic nerve injury, and someone will examine them and say, this pupil's dilated. You know, they've got intracranial hypertension. They need a craniotomy. If you have intracranial hypertension, your GCS is 8 or less. You know, it is not 15. Mm-hmm. So you also need to put those two things together.
I have three scenarios before we go into our tips and tricks that I just want you to touch on.
Because are you going to start with the second one first?
You beat me to the punchline. So three common scenarios for trauma surgeons out there, or people, general surgeons in many cases, who do community-based trauma. They get the guy that has the occult pneumothorax. Does that person who is otherwise stable looking at you, who wants to go home? They're like, I want to go home. Should we be admitting these patients, high flow oxygen? And let's say it's 10%, 5%. Not that's kind of substantially down in 30%. That's scenario one. I'll let you address that one, then I'll go to the other two.
So first thing you need to define, is it an occult pneumo or is it just a small pneumo? So an occult, remember the definition is mm-hmm. not seen on X-ray, but seen on CT. Mm-hmm. Or now seen on ultrasound, which actually will pick up pneumos better than a chest X-ray. So in that scenario, we have pretty good data that those patients almost never need anything done. They definitely don't need a chest tube at that time. The only scenario I would worry is if they're getting put on positive pressure ventilation, they're going to the OR, they're intubated and going to the ICU. Even in those scenarios, we know it's safe to watch them, but there is a certain percentage that will develop a larger pneumothorax. Going home, I think that's really questionable. But if they look great, they have a CT that showed just an occult pneumothorax, I would give them a couple hours, get another chest X-ray, and if that shows no pneumothorax, I'd be pretty comfortable letting them go if they're reliable, if they have somebody with them. But most of those patients will get admitted because they'll have something else and need at least overnight observation. The other issue, though, is the small pneumo. So chest X-ray, and you've got that small 10% apical pneumo. Those patients should not go home. Mm-hmm. There's definitely an incidence of progression. The question is, what do you do for that? Usually don't need a chest tube unless they're symptomatic. You know, now there's a lot of talk about just put a pigtail in it. Pigtail works just as well as a chest tube for pneumothorax. Again, if they're not symptomatic, I think you can just put them on oxygen and watch them. The other thing that's pretty well supported in the literature is doing an aspiration. Mm-hmm. So you put a thoracentesis, you know, catheter in, aspirate the pneumo, then take it out, and then get a follow-up chest X-ray. And that'll resolve 80 to 90% of small pneumos. And then they won't reaccumulate. So I think that's a nice in-between measure where the patient doesn't need to have a pigtail or chest tube in them.
That's assuming Kevin doesn't make it worse with his sore thoracentesis. But yeah. Second,
well, on the other side.
Second similar type scenario of the person who has an altered mental status, has a loss of consciousness, comes in as a little bit goofy, but then kind of comes to and they have a normal head CT. Should we be watching those patients? Should we be repeating that CAT scan in any way, shape, or form?
Another hot area of debate. I think we all know if they have a negative head CT and GCS 15, they virtually never require anything else done. They're going to probably have some concussive symptoms if they lost consciousness, but we don't really do anything for that in the hospital. But some people will say, you know, admit them, they need a COG eval, they need, you know, TBI teaching, et cetera. But if you look at those really don't involve anything, because it's really given them at least a couple weeks or even months to see how their concussive symptoms sort out. So I'm perfectly comfortable sending home the patient who has a negative CT, a GCS 15, nothing else that needs to be admitted. Barring probably two scenarios, which are the extremes of age. So you have the very young kid or baby who, again, following their GCS is not as easy as an adult. And then that also raises the issue of possible non-accidental trauma. Those patients, mm-hmm. I'll be more tend to admit. And then the elderly, or especially the patient who's on anticoagulants mm-hmm. or antiplatelet agents, those patients should not go home because they do have an incidence of, you know, bleeding that can occur even after a negative head CT. So if they're on Plavix and aspirin or, you know, Coumadin, I'll admit those patients at least overnight. They don't need routine repeat head CTs unless something changes in their exam, which is why you admit them and observe them and do serial exams.
And then the last scenario is the outside of the distracting injury or altered mental status with drugs or alcohol or anything like that, the patient who has a reliable, just you feel the back of their neck and they're going for CAT scan of their head anyway for whatever reason. Are we over CAT scanning these people's necks? Is clinical examination with just pressing on the neck enough alone to avoid that CAT scan of the neck? And this, we talk about cost savings and one thing, and yet we're scanning people like crazy.
Oh, we overscan everything.
Yeah.
I mean, let's face it. It's not only used as a diagnostic tool, it's a disposition tool. Mm-hmm. You know, in some cases, people say, I'll scan everything because if it's negative, I'll send them home. Mm-hmm. So the C-spine, you know, I mean, this isn't new. We've got very good data from the Nexus and the Canadian trials that if they meet all those criteria, you can clear them clinically. The problem is not many of our trauma patients meet those criteria, particularly the non-intoxicated criteria.
Right, right.
And those patients, I think, especially if you're scanning them or if you're scanning their head, you know, chest, abdomen, pelvis, it does not add anything to add their C-spine in. It's really the patients that you wouldn't scan otherwise. If they have a normal exam and they're awake and non-intoxicated, sure, you can clear them. If they're intoxicated, you don't need to scan their C-spine. You can wait till they're sober and then do a clinical exam and clear them based on that or re-image them. The big question has really been, what about the patient who has pain or what about the patient who's not examinable? And not going to become examinable. So, you know, the patient's intubated, has a brain injury. And the standard approach has been you get a CT, but you still can't clear them because mm-hmm. they're not examinable. And then you either need to wait it out and keep in a collar for, you know, weeks or get an MRI has probably been the most common approach. We now have multiple studies that have shown that modern CT scanners, a high-quality CT, essentially rules out an unstable injury, and MRI adds very little. And in fact, the miss rate on CT is as low or lower than the false rate on MRI. This has been slow to be adopted, but actually the Eastern Association for Surgery of Trauma just came out with their new C-spine clearance guidelines for the obtunded or unexaminable patient, and it now says take the collar off with a high-quality CT scan, which a lot of places have been practicing, but we've never had a national guideline that supported that. We do now, and I think that's the perfectly reasonable approach, and that's how I practice.
Yeah, it goes without saying the standard disclaimer that obviously individual cases may vary, and what we're talking about in these three scenarios are just, you know, the kind of the overall general theme of this.
Well, it's just been great. Now we're moving into the segment called the Tips and Tricks. This is where we get advice from our experts that help us get out of those sticky situations. So, Dr. Martin, I just wanted to present you with a patient who comes into the trauma bay who has a penetrating injury to the chest. Let's say it's within the cardiac box. I was wondering if you could walk us through, first off, just your initial approach to that patient in, one, the stable patient, and two, the unstable patient.
Okay, sure. So this would be the pimp up session.
Yes, exactly.
So the unstable. So obviously, your first branch point is unstable versus stable, and then the other initial consideration is what's the mechanism. So gunshot wound or stab wound, because those are a little different.
Let's go stab wound.
Okay, so stab good because stab wound's the easy one. you know, a high survival even with a cardiac injury. So a stab wound in what we would call the box. Or just, you know, in the chest. The first thing people don't appreciate is that the chest can extend almost down to the belly button, depending on the movement of the diaphragms, and definitely up to the clavicles. So any wound in that area has a potential, one, to hit the heart or other mediastinal structures, two, to give you a pneumo or hemo, and three, to have a diaphragm injury. And so I think those are your three considerations. Obviously, your number one is tension pneumo, hemo, or a cardiac injury. And I approach those patients, so what we usually do is a patient arrives and then everybody jumps on them. Mm-hmm. And then 10, 15 minutes later, you know, when the IVs are in and blood's drawn, you try and get the x-ray moved in. So I pre-position an x-ray plate when I know they're coming with the bed sitting up. And as soon as they get, if they arrive, unless they're in arrest, put them on the table and have the x-ray ready to shoot. Shoot the x-ray, then everyone comes in and does everything. And especially if you have a digital x-ray machine, you see it right there as soon as they shoot it. If you have a normal x-ray, you don't have a tension pneumo, you don't have a hemothorax. And then your next question is the heart hit? And you do an ultrasound. That's the plain and simple answer. Fast false negative is a real thing, except for the pericardial window. Pericardial window is highly reliable if you have an adequate view. If you have a negative pericardial view on your ultrasound, they do not have a significant effusion. The problem is if you have an equivocal view, or a positive is easy too. You know, if they've got a big effusion, they've got a cardiac injury. The problem is the equivocal one. And that really happens in obese patients, patients with pneumothorax where there's air interfering with your windows, or patients with a big hemothorax. That's the only places where the pericardial view is unreliable. And your answer there is, if it's a pneumo or hemothorax, you put a chest tube in, drain it, and then you repeat your ultrasound. It can also be helpful if you just can't get a good view and you have someone a little better than you, which would be an echocardiographer, a cardiologist, or an echo tech to come in and do a good exam. But if they're unstable and they have fluid on your ultrasound, then you don't need to do a pericardial window or anything else. You have your diagnosis, you do a median sternotomy, and you fix their heart. So that would be the stab wound to the chest. The gunshot wound would be the same approach. Other than you got to know where the bullet went and where it is. Is it a through and through? You know, did it go into the abdomen? Did it go up into the neck? So you just need to add that additional diagnostic workup. But otherwise, I think the principles are the same. For the gunshot wound, you worry about a transmediastinal injury too. The old approach to that, you know, we talk about you do an angiography, you do an esophagoscopy, you do a bronchoscopy. CT scan has really replaced that for the stable patient. So stable patient, do a good quality CT scan. You can reconstruct the bullet tract usually, and then you can see what structures might have been injured and direct your workup accordingly.
What is the role of an operative pericardial window?
So I think that's the role of that is the equivocal. The equivocal ultrasound, where you're not sure, you have a positive ultrasound with some pericardial fluid in a completely stable patient. I think those are reasonable to do the pericardial window to see if it's blood or not, and then proceed with a median sternotomy if it's positive. Although there is data now, including a randomized trial of patients with penetrating cardiac injuries that are stable, of just placing a pericardial drain, which. And if you mention that to most trauma surgeons, they'll literally seize. But there was a randomized trial now that shows that approach was safe, and that's because generally if they're stable, those injuries are usually tangential. They bleed a little and then stop, and you drain the pericardium. So I think that's an area that we need to have a lot more data in. But it's also, you know, an interesting point that a lot of these injuries don't need to be fixed. And generally, if they have a real cardiac injury, they're not stable. So they're going to have tamponade.
Now we're going to go into our final five. These are five questions that we ask each one of our experts to get to know you a little bit better. The first question, number one, do you listen to music in the OR? And if so, what type of music?
I do listen to music, and it's an assault because I'm listening to whatever the resident or the OR nurse puts on or brought in. I do like to listen to music in the OR unless, you know, you're having a complicated case, you run into some problem, and then you really need to have good communication, and then I think you turn the music down. But no, I enjoy music in the OR, but I have very little say in that usually. It's usually whatever the resident or nurse.
If you did have your say, what would it be?
If you hook up my iPhone, there'd probably just be a crazy mix of stuff I've downloaded. I like a lot of classic rock. The other thing is the best album ever, Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon.
Nice.
I find that to be pretty relaxing in the OR. And then closing, I like louder music, a little hillbilly rock.
Awesome. Number two, do you have any hidden talents, any hobbies outside of the operating room, outside of the hospital, that you would be willing to share with us?
I used to have a talent of basketball that we used to play actually every week in residency until age hit me. Things I like to do are generally, athletic activities, sports, running. Again, used to run a lot. Used to run marathons until age hit me. And then probably the other thing is skiing. We like to take at least one ski trip a year, usually in conjunction with one of the meetings like Western Trauma.
That lines into number three. Can you tell us about a favorite trip, vacation, or destiny that you've gone on that's memorable?
My favorite trips have always been to Europe, and in Europe, my favorite place has been Greece, and after that has probably been Florence, Italy, and of course Paris. That's where I got engaged to my wife after, I can't remember if it was my second or third deployment, when I should have asked her 5 years ago, and we went to Paris and got engaged there. But I love Europe, love Greece, and haven't had a chance to get back for a couple years.
Number four, if you didn't go into surgery, what career do you think you'd be in right now?
Interesting question. As I said, I was ROTC in college, and then I applied for a medical school deferment. And as the Army is, the Army usually gives you exactly what you want.
Yeah.
So believe it or not, they denied that. And so then I had to get branched into the Army, and my first choice was armor, which is tanks. So I went to armor school. I was a tank platoon leader, and actually I love that. I actually really like that. I considered just doing that and sticking with an Army career, as a tank officer. So it came down to that point where I had to make a decision of, I had always planned to go to med school, of, do I apply to med school and go that route, or do I just, take this route that I really loved? What made it easier is I got to the point where I was going to move up to my next job, which would usually be an executive officer, which means you're the admin and coffee person for the commander. so that at least made it relatively simple choice. So at that point, I decided, I'll continue with what my plan was and go to medical school.
And regretted it ever since. Number five, if you could go back and talk to yourself on your first day of surgical internship, what piece of advice would you give yourself?
Stay away from my co-intern, Scott Stewart. And just watch everything he does, learn from it, and do the exact opposite. So that's a great question. What could you say if you're looking back with all you know now? One thing is, one of my first cases as an intern was with our program director, Bill Williard, who was a very intimidating guy. Top of his field. Nice guy, but we would obviously get nervous operating with him, and that was the first time ever operating with him. And of course, it was a patient with Hep B, Hep C, HIV. I think we were doing a hernia repair, and then we were about to start, and the nurse handed the scalpel up, and Dr. Williard stopped her and looked at me and said, listen, just I want you to know one thing on this case. If you stab me, you better just turn around and stab yourself, because I'm going to stab you. So I think that was great advice for intern year. But probably the biggest thing, for being a physician is be present, learn all you can, and for being a surgeon, it's get to the OR. We seem to have lost a lot of that, and people now scrub in a lot only on cases where they're the operating resident. But the best learning experiences I had as a junior was scrubbing in on cases and just watching and seeing, what would I do in that situation, or how do I assist? How do I retract? How is this done? We did a lot less cases at that time as interns in R2s, but by the time we got to an R3, we'd seen every one of those a bunch of times. We've lost a little bit of that because our volume has increased and residents are spread out, and there's the work week, 80-hour work week, et cetera. But that would be probably my biggest piece of advice for a surgeon is get to the OR, scrub in as much as possible, and learn from all the different approaches the different staff have.
Well, Matt, obviously, we were interns together. We were residents together. We were staff for the last 10 years together and deployed to foreign countries, both Iraq and Afghanistan together. So as I move on, it's been a real pleasure. And we cannot thank you so much for not only the last 20 years of our life, but also for joining us today on Behind the Knife.
Does that mean I have to take my job getting out of the Army in Cleveland together?
Exactly. You never know where life is, but we really appreciate it, and thanks a lot.
Yeah, well, thanks. Thanks a lot. This has been great. Sorry. Has anybody told you that they think of serial killers when they
That was intentional.
When I see BTK, I think of bind, torture, kill. That's a great choice, which is appropriate for a lot of surgeons. Yeah.
All right. Well, that ends our session here, and we look forward to seeing you next time.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks. Well, that does it for us today. Thank you for joining us on Behind the Knife. Special thanks to Dr. Matthew Martin for sharing with us his experience in combat trauma and trauma resuscitation. Join us next time as we go Behind the Knife with another leader in surgery.
You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher and any other podcast app. We really want you guys to subscribe and also to rate us and give us reviews on iTunes. And we really enjoy connecting with you guys on Twitter. We're learning a lot, and we've made some great friends at meetings and got people involved in the podcast through Twitter. So follow us at Behind the Knife.
Yeah, in addition, we've actually incorporated some of your ideas, talking about some of the upcoming episodes that are going to come out regarding having some interviews, back and forth debates. So we appreciate your input, and we'll try to make it come to life.
All right, looks like count's correct. The fascia is closed and the dressings are on.
Until next time, thank you for joining us on Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Dominate the day.